And we're at episode 92 of the Cherokee Rewind. We thank you so much for hanging out with us here. And we're going to go, not too far back. Probably about not quite a decade and a half. Okay, maybe. Right in that neighborhood. But we're going to say hi to a guy who, if I'm not mistaken, by the way, his name is Alex Wall. And I call him Wally. That's the way it was back then. So if you hear me refer to him as such, that's why. Anyway, Alex, welcome, first of all, and thanks for doing this episode. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, Mick, I'm so happy to be here. I have a lot of feelings about my Cherokee days. I'd say 90% of them are great, and I'm just so excited that we can have a chance to talk about them.
Hey, no question. Now, one of the things I do with each player, I try to remember, now mind you, I did 20 years with the Cherokee. You know, I tell people the reason I retired was because I aged out at 20. But doing 20 years playing this way, but you got 20 years worth of names, you know, and they all run together with the years and stuff. But one of the things I try to do is I try to remember the number you wore when you played in Toledo. And I'm trying to think, because you were a defenseman, weren't you?
I was a defenseman when I came back with Motor City, but when I played for Toledo, I was a forward playing wing. Okay. I took the number of fan favorite who
I'm going to guess here. I'll guess right now. Was it 26 or was it 28?
It was 26. Austin Seipel's old number, who eventually came back to the team.
Yep, Sipes.
So
I remember Sipes real well. It's funny you say that, because I would see Austin every once in a while at work, because he worked in the same organization that I did, and we would chit chat a little bit. And I remember one time, this is a while back, but one time we were talking about him playing hockey, and he was telling some of his coworkers in his department that were at the desk, sitting at the desk he was at, he was telling them, you know, yeah, I used to play hockey, blah, blah, blah. Well, it just so happened when I went home that night that I found an old Cherokee program and he was on the cover. And so, you know, talk about a favorite.
Yeah.
And he was a Maumee guy, Maumee native. And so I took it into him and I said, here, with my compliments. And he's like, oh my God, are you kidding me? You know, he couldn't believe it because he didn't even have it. And so I gave him the program and stuff. And it was, all the people around him had to go, oh my God, you still look the same. You're so cute. And all this other stuff. And he just was rolling his eyes. But yeah, that's Sipes for you, man. And I want to talk a couple of things with him later that you remember from a certain little scrap, a little tete-a-tete that Toledo had with that team over in Iowa. We'll get into that here in just a little bit. But first off, I want to talk. Now, were you a guy from around the Detroit area, weren't you?
So I grew up just outside of Toledo, actually, in Monroe. I was born in Toledo and then spent most of my childhood and adolescence in Monroe, Michigan.
Gotcha. Okay, so we split the difference halfway in between. But
yeah.
But so what, I mean, were you an Ice Hawk growing up playing in that program there?
I was, yeah. So my first days on the ice were mostly in Ann Arbor. I was playing in, like, I guess the equivalent of the Timbits kind of program, and got my start up in Ann Arbor, and then eventually Monroe opened a rink, and I stayed with the Ice Hawks for a while. I played a lot of house hockey, and then I started to get, like, I don't know, I just grew a lot faster than a lot of the other kids in my area. So by that alone, I just started to dominate, like, the local house leagues, and then it kind of took it from there.
Now, what got you interested in hockey? I mean, being a guy from the Toledo Monroe area right here, just on the state line, was there someone that got you interested in the game? How old were you when you put on a pair of skates?
You know, I think I was 5 or 6, and this was right around the time the Red Wings were just really starting to dominate. 95, they lost to the Devils in the finals. 96, 97, they won the cup. So I think my mom was just really interested in the game of hockey and had been a Red Wings fan her whole life and just wanted me to give it a shot. So she put me on skates. No one else in my family had ever played before. And my parents were extremely supportive and were all about the 6 a.m. Saturday practices. So, I mean, I didn't know any better and I got to sleep in the car. But yeah, so I credit my mom totally.
Now, when you play, I mean, you were probably in that age group where it started to not be so much of an impact, but Mighty Ducks movies, did you grow up watching those? Or
I did, and I think that I loved them, and I love the TV show that just came out too. But you know, obviously, you have to, like, as somebody who's really into hockey, you have to watch it knowing that it's totally an embellishment of what the game's really like. But those movies definitely had an impact on me as a kid, and they made it seem like going to the next level was attainable. You know, going to the Goodwill games, which I don't even know if that's really like a thing.
That was when, back when things got real political and people weren't going to the Olympics because of where they were being held. So I think it was Ted Turner who used to own CNN and TBS and that, all that group of networks, TNT. He put together him and somebody else put together the Goodwill games, and where there was people that weren't going to the Olympics. That's how it started. Now it kind of took on a life of its own after that, but they don't even have it anymore. So it didn't last
very long. That makes sense. But, you know, thinking about that, watching those kids, they were just these scrubby kids from Minnesota who started off as not very good hockey players. I watched those movies as a little kid and thought, dude, I could totally see myself getting to that level. And, you know, obviously every kid thinks they're going to go pro, but I would say those movies kind of did it for me.
Yeah. So now, were you always a forward growing up, or did you spend any time on D?
I mostly played forward. I love to hit. I love to forecheck. I didn't score a lot, but I just loved the grittier side of the game. And you know, when you're bigger than everybody growing up, it's a lot easier. But then, you know, you get to juniors, and I think I was the second smallest guy on the team other than Mark Farrell. Yeah. Things changed a lot.
Yeah, I bet it did. We'll get to that in a little bit, especially with that guy. Anyway, so you grew up, and now how old were you when you transitioned from Ann Arbor over to Monroe?
I was probably 9 or 10 years old. I was, you know, still pretty young, and it was just a lot closer to home. So it was so easy for us to just, you know, head over 15 minutes away to the rink. It was kind of a game changer for us, us being my family.
Yeah, I understand. Now, who was your coach back then? Do you remember?
Well, I had these guys in Ann Arbor that I think really helped me fall in love with the game of hockey. And they were the Upton brothers. Their dad played for U of M back in the 40s or 50s. He was old school. And these guys, I can't even remember their first names. I just remember their last name is Upton. And they made hockey so fun. And it was such a pivotal time for me because, you know, coaches can be really tough, and they just really focused on enjoying the game and development. And I think they really helped me fall in love with the sport. And I actually have, talking about them now makes me really want to reach out and just thank those guys, but I don't know how to find them. I'll have to do some research. But then in Monroe, I had a coach, I think his first name was Bob. God, I don't know why, but I know his last name was Marshall, and he was a tough guy. And I actually ended up quitting his team to go play for a different rival travel team at some point and kind of burned that bridge. But he was a good coach while I had him, and I drawn a blank on his first name for some reason.
Okay. So, but now What was the name of the team that you played for when you left?
I went to this team called AFI, and my coach's name was Dan Vasquez, and he ended up being a big part of the Motor City Chiefs organization. And but he recruited me. He saw me play one time when my Monroe IceHawks team played against AFI. They beat the heck out of Monroe, but he liked how I played, and I had some friends on that team, and I thought that I'd probably get exposed to a lot more stuff joining that team. So I just resigned from Monroe, which in hindsight I kind of feel bad about. But it was like mid-season, and then I went to this team called AFI up in the Downriver Detroit area, and we went to all kinds of tournaments. We had some guys that were so skilled. People just I was exposed to so much more hockey wise, life wise. And Dan, I think, was maybe one of the most important coaches of my life, other than the Uptons. And he recently passed away from COVID, but he was just one of those guys that really gave me a shot, and never regretted it, and was always so respectful, and I wish I could have thanked him, but alas, it's been a crazy year, and
Well, I'm
sadly, we
sure he's
lost
up
him.
there. I'm sure he's up there, and he knows you're grateful. So, you were talking about some of this stuff as far as, going to Downriver. Was it easier to? I mean, as far as the schedule goes, how hard did that impact you? As far as like, I mean, most kids at your age or during that time, with that time frame of age. Usually you have to think about things like, homework, school, getting it all done and stuff. I mean, how many kids, like, I'm sure you probably did it yourself, that had to do homework on the in the car or, things like that, because of traveling to tournaments. How talk about how the challenge of schoolwork versus, tournaments, because we all will take tournaments over schoolwork any day, but the idea that you have to get this stuff done before you go into the classroom on Monday morning.
School is tough. I loved school, and I was pretty good at it without putting any effort into it. And I would say that my hockey career was the same to an extent, to a certain point. Like, I didn't go to the weight room. I didn't do a lot of studying. I just was good at it. And so with my schoolwork, I hated doing it in the car. So I would just stay up really late after practice. And at that age, like you turn into a teenager. You're playing in a more advanced team. You're getting the later practices. Your practices are at like 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock on a weeknight. And especially in the Metro Detroit area, there's just such a high demand for ice time. So yeah, you're getting late practices. You're getting home late from practice or from your games. And then if you didn't do your homework before practice, you're going to be up until like 1 or 2 in the morning studying. So I was sleeping a lot during my classes in school. Not intentionally, but I was nodding off all the time.
That's don't worry. That's something that you probably shared with about maybe 70% of everybody else in class. And let's put it this way: if they offered it as like a, I could have gotten my doctorate in sleeping during class. But that's just another story for another time. Anyway, so now. When did you start playing more travel hockey as far as getting more committed into that?
I think my first big travel season was that year 12. I was 12 or 13, Bantams, I think, and I was playing for the IceHawks, like I mentioned, and then I went to that AFI team, and it was a Bantam Double A team, and they played as if they were a Triple A team. We played Triple A tournaments. We scrimmaged like Little Caesars, CompuWare, all these squads. Put up a good fight. I mean, we didn't ever beat them really, but the games were competitive, and we trained and played as if we were a AAA organization, just with a AA budget. And that was, I think, when I started to become a lot more serious about hockey. you know, schedule commitments, all that stuff. It turned up to a whole other level after joining that squad.
Now, did you play at that point? Did you play any other sports besides hockey?
I played a little soccer as a little kid. I played football in sixth and eighth grade, and I did a little bit of track, but I was mostly focused on hockey. And I know now I'm a coach here in New York City. And I know that USA Hockey is huge on kids being multi-sport athletes up until they're, you know, older teenagers to kind of get exposed to different things. But I had no interest in anything other than hockey.
Who was being from this area, were you primarily a Wings fan or Detroit Red Wings fan?
Oh yeah, big time. Huge Wings fan, a huge Michigan hockey fan. I grew up idolizing all those guys. And I think more than wanting to be a pro, I really, more than anything, wanted to play for the University of Michigan. I just wanted to play for Red Berenson. I wanted to play at Yost Ice Arena. I wanted to wear the maize and blue. And, you know, none of those things ever happened. But in my head as a kid, it sounded so sick. And that was always my goal, more than like making the big bucks in the NHL.
Now, who were some of the players that you grew up being a big fan of?
Oh man, you know, I loved Stevie Y, Steve Yzerman. Loved Sergei Fedorov. I think my favorite player of all time was Jack Johnson. You know, big Michigan hockey guy. He didn't have the best NHL career, but in college, I don't think I've ever seen anyone so electric or so fun to watch. So that was a guy I always looked up to. Yeah, I don't know. I guess all the heavy hitters, though. Stevie Y, Sergei, Brendan Shanahan, you know, all the big Red Wings.
Yeah, I was reading on social media, I was reading a story about Brendan Shanahan. When he was 14 years old, he met one of his heroes, Rick Vive of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and he tried to get his autograph, and he got... Basically, Vive just said, "Get out of here, kid. You bother me." And 4 years later, Shanahan gets to play in the NHL, gets drafted and plays in the NHL, and gets the first time they play the Maple Leafs, he gets into a fight with Rick Vive and beats a snot out of him. You know, so it's funny.
Oh wow!
You know, so but
that's so satisfying. I guess they say don't meet your heroes. But if you do, I guess you'll end up beating the heck out of them 4 years later.
Yeah, apparently that's the lesson to be learned. But now, when you had to make that decision as far as whether you wanted to go and play at a higher level, whether it was AAA or maybe trying high school, staying home and playing high school, what route did you take?
You know, I kind of had my decision made for me because my high school didn't have a team, and there wasn't really a team in my town until my senior year. There was a private school where I lived. The hockey wasn't very good, and actually, I don't want to say it was bad. Like, I think a couple ex-Cherokee players played there. Adam Pagula, I know he did an episode with you. He played for SMCC. I just wasn't interested in going to the private school. So I thought my only option was to just stick with travel. And so that's kind of what I did until I was 16 when I joined the Cherokee.
Okay. So now who did you play for? Was it AAA or AA?
So that team, AFI, that AA team I was mm-hmm. playing for, they turned into an independent AAA team called the Detroit Trackers. And we had these wild black and silver camouflage jerseys, and our helmets and our gloves and our pants were all silver. They looked really, we were pretty ridiculous looking, but had a lot of good players. There's a lot of the guys from AFI just playing on a AAA team. And, you know, we had more formal competitions against those teams like Little Caesars and Beltire. We did one time beat CompuWare, which was maybe the most exciting win I've ever been a part of. And then we got whooped by them in states. So, wow. You know, it didn't really matter.
Paybacks. Yeah, but, So now, what were you trying out at different camps and stuff as a 16-year-old? Did you find, I mean, were you recruited? How, what was it that eventually led you to coming to Toledo?
So I played for the Detroit Trackers for 2 seasons, and then I ended up at this tournament in Chicago called EHK, is a showcase, and a couple guys from the Cherokee were there. And I'm drawing a blank on the name, but it was, I think he was the GM when I played for the Cherokee.
That Tom Higgins, maybe?
It wasn't Tom Higgins. Tom was definitely involved. But it wasn't Tom.
No, I think Mike Robertson
If
had
you
left.
said his name, it might have been Mike Robertson. I
Was
don't
it?
know. I'm tempted to
Okay.
Google him.
Okay, yeah, Robertson. He was kind of a shorter guy.
That sounds about right.
Okay, then
Yes.
that would be Mike then.
He had black hair.
Yep, that's him.
Yep. So he approached me at the camp. I think he knew I was local, and he said that he liked how I was playing, and I was aware of the Cherokee because I grew up in the area, and so he invited me out to one of the open tryouts or open camps. I think it was maybe in April or May, and I had a great camp. I was feeling super confident. I don't know what it was, but my head was in the right place. And it seemed like everything was going to go great. Varga was the coach, and he seemed to really take a liking to me. And so yeah, I signed with the Cherokee, I think, and then there was a more formal fall tryout or like late summer camp that solidified the roster. But I felt like I was a part of things, and I was so excited to get going. And it was I don't know, one of the most exciting times of my hockey career. I was like, holy crap, I'm about to play juniors in
That'd be pretty cool. So now, let me ask you, when you were coming in and said, "Hey, I'm playing juniors," what was the fit? What can you tell me what it was like when you went into that locker room the first time? Were you nervous? Was it excitement? What was it like?
I was nervous, I think. Varga was no longer with the organization when I joined the team. Ian Duncan took over, and he was a super intimidating guy. Like, he obviously great coach, great hockey career, Toledo superstar. But he had a serious side to him that I was super intimidated by. I was a 16-year-old kid playing hockey with a bunch of men like Tommy Higgins, Bart Reeves, Corey Abeglin. All these guys were, in their second to last year or last year of junior hockey, and I was 16 years old. Hadn't had my first beer ever.
I'm sure they probably changed
Yeah,
that.
I don't know. I just was in a completely different it took a little while actually, but yeah, I mean, they eventually got to me. But yeah, I don't know. I don't think heading into that into that first season, I don't know if I was really mentally ready for it. It was a huge step up from my travel days.
Yeah, I bet it was. So, I mean, what was the how long, I mean, I guess how long did it take you to make the adjustment and feel comfortable playing with those guys and playing for Dunk and just being, like feeling like, hey, I'm there and I'm ready to go?
That's a great question, and it's something that I think about all the time still, even though I'm 31 years old. I don't know if I ever felt super comfortable, and I don't think it was anyone else's fault but my own. Like, mentally, my confidence was gone. I had gone from being, one of the bigger guys on my team or in my league, and being a pretty I don't want to say dominant player, but like I got stuff done. I scored goals, I made plays, and I hit. And you know, going to juniors, it was just, the game was so much faster and you had to be much more intentional about what you did with the puck. And I just did not trust myself. Anytime I'd get the puck, I would throw it away. So, I think about this all the time because it's so funny. You know, you play like beer league as an adult and the game's so much slower and you're like, man, if I had these skills and this confidence 10 years ago, I'd be in the NHL now. But, you know, obviously that's just not how it works. But yeah, sorry, to get back to your question, the guys were all great. Like, but it took a long time for me to settle in. And even at the end of the season, I'm not sure I had fully ever really like,
felt 100% comfortable.
Settled into a groove.
Yeah, I understand that. You know, what's the old saying? If ifs were fifths, we'd all be drunk. But you got to realize something too here, is that part of the reason you were recruited was because you knew, you felt, you know, obviously you were going to play for Coach Varga. And then when he got let go, and it was Ian Duncan, and I mean, they are about as opposite in terms of night and day as far as personality, as far as, you know, trying to, I guess the way they run systems, the way they run their organization, they're very different guys, both successful guys. Chris Varga is the head coach here in Toledo at St. Francis High School and has won several state championships. So, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And that has helped get more high school kids locally to come and play for the Toledo Cherokee because the coaching at the high school level has gotten so much better. Not that they weren't before, but I think just in terms of these kids, you know, the kids would play high school and then be done. Now these kids that are playing high school, they want to, after their high school career is done, they know they've got options. They can go to, you know, like University of Toledo, or if they want to play the junior, go the juniors route, they've got the Cherokee. And the thing is that these kids, a lot of them weren't always ready to make that jump. And, but because there are, you know, newer, seasoned coaches like Varga who coached at the junior level. You know, you've got guys like that, Derek Stumm, who won a national championship with the Cherokee back in 1998. He's coaching over at St. John's. You know, you've got guys with the junior experience that are coaching these kids and are building them up, making them, you know, toughening them up so that if they want to make that jump after high school to go play at the junior level, you know, they're getting, you know, the local kids are getting better. And I think that helps. That helps grow the game. But the thing is that, again,
yeah,
you have to be comfortable with the, you know, you can love somebody, like and love somebody great as a person, but sometimes in a certain capacity of their lives, whether it's as a coach or even if you're an employee and your employer is someone who you respect and you're like, okay, yeah, he's a great worker, he's a great boss, but you don't always feel comfortable around him. And sometimes that happens, you know, and that doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means that it's like trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. And whether or not you're able to make that adjustment, it's not always an easy thing to do. It's easy to say, but it's incredibly tough to do.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, what you're saying right now is exactly kind of how I felt when, you know, when Varga, I don't know totally the circumstances about, you know, his no longer being with the Cherokee, but I was kind of devastated by him getting let go because I felt like I was his guy. I felt like I was a guy that he was excited about and, you know, was excited to coach. And then when Duncan came in, you know, I wasn't a guy that he picked. You know, I wasn't his player, and I don't think he ever really trusted me as a player, and therefore I don't think I ever really trusted myself as a player. And you know, there were a couple of guys on the team like Nick Yost and Doug Linensmith who were also my age. We were both 1990. We're all 1990 birth years, 16-year-old kids. But I think they were just a bit more cut out for that level of play at that time. Whereas I don't think I was quite there mentally. Physically, maybe, but mentally, I just think I needed a little more time to season in either high school or you know, play travel still.
That's understandable. I mean, hey, you know, I mean, at least, you know what, I mean, and it tells me about your maturation level now, because the fact that you can look back and honestly assess it, mm-hmm. I think that says a lot about you. The fact that, you know, you can identify things, and that doesn't mean that you're there was no use for you or something. No, that's not true at all. It just meant that you were able to identify parts of your game that needed improvement, or things in your game that in the mental part was something you're identifying as, and that's a very key part of the game, of your makeup as far as a hockey player is concerned. So I tip my hat to you for being able to, you know, figure that out, because not a lot of guys do. Usually what they'll do is there are guys that sometimes they'll try to, you know, find fault in everyone else but themselves, you know. And I, you know, it's like, okay, you know, I understand, you know, circumstances happen, you know, that's just life. But when you're able to have mm-hmm. the maturity level to be able to, you know, just say, hey, there were some things I wasn't ready for. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, but the thing is that by identifying them yourself, I think that says that, you know what, okay, so it wasn't the greatest experience on planet Earth. Bigger tragedies have happened in life. I can move on, still, you know that happened, but still be able to go play and have fun, made some friends, some great friends along the way, and, you know, got to care for some people that I grew to be really fond of, and, you know, just enjoy, you know, it was funny too, is one of the little, you know, I remember bits and pieces about guys, little things that are like most people would consider a throwaway and wouldn't even think twice about it when they said something. But for some reason, I remember little bits and pieces about people. Here's one thing I remember about you. Besides the fact that you used to really cheese off a lot of guys, especially like right around the whistle, you know, and stuff like that. You're a crap disturber. And here's the funny part that I remember this like it was yesterday, and I don't know why. There's no rhyme or reason to it whatsoever. You were, it was at camp. And, it wasn't at camp. I had you as an intermission guest for an intermission to play during the season for an intermission. And I was recording an interview with you, and we were talking about something about interests. And I said, so, what kind of a music guy are you? You know, are you hip hop or rap or rock or what? You know, and you're like, no, I'm more of a mellow guy. I like, mellow stuff that, you know, I'm different from a lot of the other guys. And don't ask me why I remember that. Don't ask me why. I have no clue, Alex, but that is the honest to God's truth. I remember that little tidbit of information. And I don't know why.
That's so funny, because I think if right now I'm making my I'm getting married this fall, and I'm making my like wedding reception playlist, and if I had my way, it would all be like sad acoustic songs. But my fiance likes hip hop and funky stuff too much, so that I don't think I'm gonna get my way here.
So try to compromise. Tell her, let's just play classic music, you know? You can play Motown, classic rock, stuff like that. Tell her to compromise. Yeah. You know, not everyone's a Lisa Lovegood.
You can catch me at Lilith Fair this year.
So at least I was right about
that. I like the more obscure, sad, yeah. No, you're totally, absolutely right. You nailed it on the head. That's exactly what I would have said.
That is too funny. I just remember that, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, this guy is different. I like this because he's different. Not, I mean, my taste in music is I'm an old classic hard rock cement head. I liked underground hard rock from the 70s and 80s. You know, that was my thing. And to this day, that's what I listen to a lot of, you know. But I mean, I also grew up with Motown, 50s jazz. You know, there was always music in my house growing up from my folks, whether it was, different types of music from different cultures, to, you know, of course I'm old, so I mean we had disco when I was a kid and I couldn't stand it, but I loved the Philadelphia sound. You know, grew up with Motown, and you know, I never was a country music guy until we have a guy that played for the Cherokee. His name's Kyle Jennings, and he's gone on now to become a musician. He's a, you know, he's released a couple of albums and stuff, and he, you know, goes back and forth between Kalamazoo, where he's originally from, and Nashville. So, you know,
Wow.
being a support, I try to support, you know, our guys. So, you know, and he's a t very, very, very talented songwriter. And you know, so I try to support our team, our alumni, as best I can. And you know, he's one of those guys. And he, like I say, he's a country music guy. And I'm not a country music guy, but I do, you know, like I say, I support him 110%, listen to his music, buy his music, all that stuff. So, but anyway, getting back to what we were talking about, though, you know, just the little tidbits and things, like I said, that I remember. Now, do you remember, did you score when you were in Toledo? Did you score your first goal there?
I scored my one and only Cherokee goal. Oh God. This is actually kind of fun. We were playing the Grand Rapids Owls, and they were, I think, the worst team in the league. And I don't know if they won a game. And I don't know if you remember very well, but I didn't get a lot of ice time, and I never got out on the power play. But we were up on these guys like 7 or 8 nothing. And Dunk put me on the power play. It's the end of the season. He's like, "I want you to get your first goal." Put me on the power play. He's like, "Just stand in front of the net." And the puck came to me. I slotted it at home on a against a kid who was from my hometown, Mike Davis. I think he tried out for the Cherokee at some point, but he ended up on the Owls. And yeah, I sent it 5-hole, and I have the puck somewhere. What was his name? Chuck Strange.
Yeah,
He
Chuck
taped the
Strange.
puck up for me. And yeah, that was a cool memory. I was grateful that Dunk had a sense of humor and wanted to get me on the ice for some, crummy power play time at the end of the game to get my first goal. Hey, and it worked.
Now, do you remember, like, I know you know, being that you didn't see the most amount of ice time, but I mean, from time to time, do you remember who some of your line mates were at all?
If I were playing at all, I was probably playing with what was his name, Brett Brody, young guy from the Carolinas, number 14, I think. I might have played a little bit with Doug Lindensmith earlier on, but as the season went on and he got a lot stronger, he played a lot more. And maybe Jake Clark. I probably played with Jake Clark a bit. He was a fourth liner. He'd muck it up a bit. A lot of fights from him on YouTube. So yeah, I think those are some of the guys I'd play with a bit.
I always called thought of him as kind of like the Keith Magnuson, or for the younger generation, the Duncan Keith kind of the team. He was the guy that was tough, rumble. If you gave him any crap, he'd put it right back, throw it right back in your face. Didn't take any crap from you, but he didn't always win all his fights. But the thing is that he always stood up for his teammates. He always had their back, no matter what. And
Yeah, he was a great teammate, I gotta say. And I don't even really remember what kind of guy he was off the ice. But I just remember on the ice, he'd always have your back. And there was the one game where I started this line brawl, and I was the only person that wasn't in the line brawl that I started. I got pulled out by the refs. And this is another funny memory. It was against Chicago Force. There's this kid, Mike Santee, who I followed his career a little bit because he went on and played D1 at West Point. But he was their star rookie or whatever on the Force, and he was holding my stick, And my stick just happened to be at throat level, but he was holding it and laughing in my face. And I asked him to fight. I called him some names and he wouldn't let go of my stick, but he also wouldn't fight me. And he just kept laughing in my face. And that just set me off. So I cross-checked him right in the throat and, not one of my prouder moments, but he went down. He was on the ice hurt for a while. Everybody starts brawling. J.R. Engelbert starts tussling with their goalie. Bart Reeves is going with somebody on the ice. I don't know. Everyone was going at it except me. And Mike Santi, the guy that I cross-checked, he's on the ice getting medical attention, and the refs like pull me aside and I get on the bench. But yeah, so everyone's going at it. And then Jay Clark, someone had to answer for my crime. So he went and fought somebody later in the game. It was just, yeah, I've always respected him for kind of just standing up for his teammates and being that kind of guy.
Yep. You know, and that's what, you know, I appreciated about him is that, you know, Jay was not, he was not afraid to, you know, back you up, even if you started it and you were the one at fault. You know, it was like, that's my teammate and I got to back him up, you know? So now who would you say probably, if you remember, who would you say was probably some of the funnier guys on the team? Who are some of the goofballs that you remember?
I mean, that team, there was no shortage of characters on the team. And I'm just remembering guys that I haven't thought of in years. Like, was John Melendez. He was one of the older guys on the team. He was a bit more stoic, but his name just kind of came back into my head. But Bart Reeves, he was hilarious. That guy was, he was always clowning with everybody. Mark Farrell, Ross Lane, all these guys were just, I sat next to Mark Farrell and Ross Lane in the locker room, and those guys were just always chuffing me and, making fun of me, but not in a hurtful way. Like, they were always just giving me crap, and I always loved them for it because it just made me feel like I was part of the team.
Yeah, and Farrell, my gosh, that guy, he was a few fries short of a Happy Meal, and that's what I loved about him. You know, he was crazy, you know, and what's funny is I think, if I'm not mistaken, he went on to become a registered nurse somewhere in the Detroit area.
Wow, good for him. You know, he was fascinating to me. He was so enigmatic. He would reveal absolutely nothing about his personal life, but he also wouldn't shut the hell up. So yep. It was like, I just could not get a read on that guy. And he was a pretty good hockey player. Like, he played hard. He was very small. He was the smallest guy probably in the league.
Yep.
But he played big. He played very big.
You know, we've had several guys like that over the years that I remember. They were like 5 foot nothing, 100 and nothing, to quote the movie Rudy. But they still played like they were, 6'5", you know. I mean, they didn't care. And Farrell was one of them. I think he was with the Michigan Ice Dogs and then he came to Toledo, or it was the other way, I think.
Yeah, he played for the Ice Dogs, and so did Timmy Werner. I don't know if you remember Tim Werner.
Dan played for us too.
Yep, Tim and Dan were both on the team.
Yep.
Yep.
So I remember both of those guys. I remember because their dad was a state trooper in Michigan.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was at the Monroe Post, and
yeah, Tim and Dan are Monroe guys.
Yep, and they were just great guys. I always liked Tim and Dan both. I mean, they were both defensemen. Tim was kind of the more, he was probably the more, I guess, for lack of a better term, he was the goofy, funnier one. And Dan was more stoic and low key, a little more serious. But they were both really good guys.
Yes.
Just really good guys. I always enjoyed talking to them and stuff on the road trips and everything. Now, who was the team that you, when you played there in Toledo, that you got fired up the most about, like, I don't like these guys. I want to get them. They really ticked me off. That kind of thing. Was there a team that really kind of got under your skin there when you played?
I mean, from my personal experience, and you know, I obviously I think I took more stats than had puck than the like than puck touches in a season. Mm-hmm. So I from watching, Dubuque was the team that I could not stand, but I don't know if I ever played against Dubuque. I think I was in the stands for most of those games. But I'd say Peoria. I hated Peoria, and I think there was just one or two goons on their team that I was terrified of, but I also hated and wanted to just like, I was like, I'm going to get in my first fight and it's going to be against these guys. And, it wasn't, I didn't get in a fight in that season, but,
it's funny. Now, tell me what you remember about,
yeah.
Tell me what you remember about the Dubuque fight that broke out. It was Nick Yost with the body check.
Yeah.
With the body check that started everything. And
oh, Mick, you don't even need to remind. I mean, you can tell our listeners all about it. But I don't need any reminder. I've watched the clip dozens of times. And I can hear you and I can hear Toby Hafner very clearly on the call. And it's a great call, by the way. And Toby was correct. It was absolutely gong show hockey. It was such a clean hit. Like it was God, that I get so fired up watching that clip because I was one of like four or five guys in the stands that game. And I watched it all unfold. It was right in front of me. Yost with the cleanest hit. And then it just spiraled out of control. And I remember being right on the glass screaming, like, get me out there. Because JC Gulch, he wasn't much of a fighter. Like, I think if we were to go back in time, you have to know what's coming if you're Duncan or if you're Tarsha. You have to know what's coming. I think Ryan Sell was out there, and I think JC Gulch were out there. Like, both of these guys are out there. They're great players, but they are not tough.
They're not huge.
So, yeah, it was just a mismatch. And then they – no, exactly. So watching JC try to, like, protect his teammates, but also, like, this guy was wailing on Seipel. The guy that JC was tied up with was, like, wailing on Seipel. And I was like, dude, get me out there. I want to just – crush these guys. I don't.
Yeah, but
yeah. I'm sorry. I'm getting really worked up about it because it's just it's so like vivid in my mind.
Yeah, but the thing is that with Sipes, Seipel turned around and then got busy, because what happened was with him and then especially J.R. Engelbert.
Yes.
When Billy Wurst went down there and tried to, tried to take him out, and J.R. ducked him. And Wurst went flying. And JR got, once he got his blocker pad off, oh my God. Lesson learned there, boys and girls, do not pick a fight with our goalie, because JR just absolutely jackhammered the guys that he fought. Because him and Sipes had two guys on him. Sipes had two guys on him.
Yeah.
And JR went over there and just jacked one of them and dropped him. Just flat out dropped him. And then Sipes got busy. And that is a kid. If you ever look at his hands, he's got the boniest knuckles I ever seen on a kid. And he's got those heavy hands. Those hands where it don't look like much, but when they hit you, they hurt you. You know? And
yes, Seipel was such a deceptive guy because he had the slimmest runner's physique. I think he was a big runner. He was extremely lean, mm-hmm. and he did not look imposing at all. But he could throw. He could throw hands. And I remember watching that fight. He was like just losing his mind out there trying to protect his teammates. But what really surprised me, I think, most was when that guy Billy Hurst or whatever went and charged JR. JR was the wrong goalie to mess with. Yeah. He was so, first of all, he's like 6'6", yep. on skates, he's probably Chara size, and he was a big dude, and he could throw too.
Yep. And you know, it's funny now he went on in Colorado, he was a golf pro. He was managing a golf course, but he got into coaching, and now he's coaching the high school there in, I can't remember the town, begins with a B. That's all I remember. Not Boulder, but, Breckenridge. That's it. Breckenridge.
Just about to say, is he coaching hockey in Breckenridge?
Yep. He's their new, he became their new head coach, this past spring. They named him as the new hockey coach. So, I can't say, you know, enough about that guy. And Sipes, a local kid from Miami. Wow. Like I said, I just remember. Yeah, you're right. It gets your blood going, man, when you start talking about this stuff and everything. I mean, and it's usually, you know, usually when I talk about it, I think about it and smile. But today, man, for some reason, I'm like, you know, it's like Joe Coombs, coach of Dubuque. How you doing? Good to see you after all these years. Get out of here, you know, or something. But funny. I mean, I've had guys on here who have gotten like in the post of the afterwards of doing the podcast, they would get kind of emotional because they're like, oh my God, I forgot all these memories are flooding back, Mick, you know, and I just, you know, I can't believe, you know, it's been that long and we did this and this, and they would get all, you know, wow, you know, it's you know, and it's like, that's because hockey is so special. Because for better or for worse, no matter what, you always can go back to that bond. You have that bond. I mean, I've talked to guys who I was really tight with when we were both on the team. And then 20 whatever years later, you know, first time I've talked to them since those days. And we pick up like right where we left off. It's like not a day went by. You know, and that's what's so great about hockey is I would say it's the tie that binds. And, you know, you might not have a whole ton in common. You may have a different favorite team, whatever. But when you start talking about hockey, all of a sudden it's like, boom, it's like, it's just so, it just, it makes it so easy to talk to another person that understands that the game that it, you know, whether they played it or whatever, they were involved in it. You have that, you guys have that commonality. And it makes it so much, makes it so much easier. They can go, oh, okay, he gets it, or that person gets it, you know. So it's easy to talk to them, you know, and stuff, you know, regardless.
Yeah, I think there is this, this like kinship that you develop, regardless of the level that you play it at. Just being involved with the game, there's this. It's unlike any other sport I've ever been a part of. And the relationships that I formed through the game of hockey and continue to form through the game of hockey are ones that have changed me in ways that I could never describe. And I get why people would be emotional after, you know, coming on this show, because I think about the Cherokee days a lot, and to a larger degree, you know, my junior hockey career. And I, like, the way I look at it every day changes. Sometimes I think back on it fondly. Sometimes I look back on it with a little bit of regret, but ultimately it shaped me into who I am. And, you know, I am who I am today because of those experiences that I shared with people like you and the rest of my teammates.
Yep. You know, and you can't go back and change it. So you can only change what's ahead of you, you know? So, and you can draw on those experiences to motivate you, to get you to where, you know, I don't want someone else to experience what I experienced. So I'm going to do this, this and this, you know, there's ways you can make good on those things, you know, and
oh yeah,
how I look at it. And now when you, after that year in Toledo, I'm trying to remember here, you came to our camp and it didn't work out. Mm-hmm. Where did you go to next?
So after that, that was an interesting season. I didn't make it out of camp. So I think they decided to go in a different direction, got some new younger guys on the squad, and I was pretty heartbroken about that. But at the same time, I knew that Duncan and I weren't on the best terms, and thought maybe it was time for me to go. So my community college, I don't know, one of the students there or whatever, I don't know who the guy was. His name was Greg Pattison, and he started a community college team. It was just like a club squad. And I was still in high school, but I was taking one class there. So I guess I qualified to play on this club squad. And I played with them for maybe 2 months or so. And a lot of the guys had never played real hockey, like real organized hockey before. And it just, I knew I still had stuff in the tank. I wanted to keep playing. So I had some buddies of mine from AFI, that team I, you know, played for a few years before. And a lot of them had moved out to Montana to play in the NORPAC for this squad called the Missoula Maulers. Okay. So it was their inaugural season. This guy, Brad Swearingen, was running the team. And he was from the Detroit area. He knew me from when I played for the Detroit Trackers and Dan Vasquez. And some of my old teammates were playing for him. So I got in touch with him, said that I wanted to come play. They signed me to a contract. I moved out to Montana. I was 17. It was like just after Christmas. And it was a similar situation to when I joined the Cherokee, because Brad seemed to really like me and seemed to, you know, be willing to give me an opportunity, give me some ice time, seemed interested in developing me as a player. And then Brad had some, some sensitive stuff happened. Brad had a really hard time. He had to leave the team. And his younger brother, Tim Swearingen, came in to coach. And Tim, I think, was like a master's student who played college hockey at Wayne State. And we'll look back on and say, I don't like that guy, but I really did not like that guy. And he, just totally killed my confidence, you know, like, if you have like leading questions, you know, or questions that you want to ask, feel free to interject. But yeah. That was hard. I was so far away from home. You know, it's like 1,800 miles away from my parents and my girlfriend at the time. And
did you ever think about maybe?
He getting, was just like, you don't
Did you ever think about asking for a trade?
Trade is because my grandma lived pretty close to Missoula. So I could see her from time to time, and, you know, this is probably a conversation for a different show, but she was kind of newer into my life at that point, and I wanted to kind of focus on that relationship.
Sure.
She was kind of like my long-lost grandma. But so I wanted to make the most of my time in Missoula. I loved my teammates, and I don't know why, but a trade just did not occur to me. And in hindsight, I probably needed a change of scenery, but Tim, the coach, was just effusive in his dislike for me and would always tell me, you don't belong here. You're not good enough to play junior hockey. No coach had ever been that, I guess, outspoken about my skill level or lack thereof, but it really just felt like counterproductive, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of building team morale and trying to get everybody to buy in.
Wow. Yeah, I would say so. So, after that season, obviously, the best thing you could have done was to get the heck out of there. I would think that a change of scenery was needed, not only just for you as far as getting a chance to play, but also, yeah, to build your confidence, but to also so that it doesn't kill your love for the sport.
Yeah. Well, the season, I left the team a little bit early. Like, they were about to go to the playoffs. I knew I was never going to get any ice time. And I knew that I wasn't really wanted by the coach. So I just asked to be released. And, you know, they finished their season. I went home, finished high school back in Michigan. And Still have great relationships with some of those guys from Missoula, and I think my favorite goal that I've ever scored was out in Missoula. I got a penalty shot against the number one team in the league, and you know, sniped on my penalty shot. That was cool. It was a sold out crowd. You know, Toledo, we had good crowds, but in Missoula, we had like, you know, 2,000 people at these games sometimes, and it was just crazy. I'd never seen anything like that in my life before that.
Yeah, that's because out in those areas, in those towns, the junior team is their de facto minor league hockey team. You know, we've got, you know, we have the Walleye here, and you know, the
right
playing the, you know, stuff, but the junior teams around here don't get the following that the minor league teams do, and then you move your way up, whether it's college or pro, you know. It's the idea that out west, you know, in towns like Missoula, in Butte, in, you know, wherever, you know, Dubuque, all those places, their junior team is the only team in town. That's the only show in town. So they get those big followings out there because they don't have a whole lot else to do. And when you spend any time in some of those towns, you kind of going, okay, I get it now, because there's nothing else to do. It's like, I'd rather, it's like you go there, you watch paint dry, and you feed the farm animal.
Yeah.
You know, so.
You're absolutely right. There was like, there wasn't much going on in Missoula. Luckily it was a college town, and there was college football, which people loved, but there was no other hockey team. So we were, that was it for them, was us, which was cool.
Now, did, when you were out there, did you get star treatment? Did they ask you like for your autograph or anything like that?
I did sign some autographs, that was cool. Yeah, we did some like local appearances and things like that. Something that I would have never imagined myself doing any of that stuff in a million years. But then going to Missoula, Montana, where the, you know, the metro to Toledo area probably has, I don't know, probably closer to a million people, and I think Missoula, Montana, probably has, I don't know, 60,000. I don't know for sure, but it's just a lot smaller.
Yeah. So where did you go after Missoula?
I actually went back to playing U18 AAA hockey. Mm-hmm. I joined this this independent team called the Motor City Machine, and they also had an NAHL squad. But I played on their U18 AAA team, coached by Jesse Davis. Jesse is one of the most unique people I've ever met. When he coached me, I think he was in his early 30s, but he was also such an enigma. I knew nothing about the guy, other than that he knew how to coach and he knew how to have fun and was hilarious. But he took a chance on me. He put me on the squad. I was an assistant captain. Played with a bunch of guys that ended up being really good players. And it made me fall in love with the game again. We were just a tournament team. We were kind of like I don't know what the term would be, but like barnstormers. We'll just come in and play a tournament and leave town, but we weren't in any particular league or anything. And the team ended up folding. I think for financial reasons, it was a lot of money. So the team folded, and then I joined the Motor City Chiefs, and I joined their Tier 3 Junior A team, the same league as the Cherokee. Mm-hmm. And they had a Junior B team though as well, and that was coached by my old coach Dan Vasquez, and he had been urging me to come and play for him. He said, "You'll get all the ice time in the world. You'll be a part of something great." And I chose to go the Junior A route, and my coach did not like me. And the more I talk about all these coaches who hated me, the more I wonder if I was the problem. But I don't know. I'm sure as an 18-year-old who wasn't getting ice time, I was probably whispering stuff under my breath or like complaining on the bench or moping around. It's probably on me, but ultimately, I didn't have a great time in Motor City, and that was kind of just the end for me. I stopped playing hockey for a while after that, and just played for fun. And then I went to Bowling Green State University I was 21 when I enrolled there as a freshman. And I knew they had a club team. I had some buddies on the club team. And I thought about playing, but at this point, I didn't want my parents to pay for my hockey anymore because they had, sacrificed so much for me to play this game. And so I just decided not to play for them. I didn't play for the club team, and I chose rugby instead. I played college rugby for 4 years,
Wow.
and it was fun. BG has an incredible rugby team, and being a part of that program was incredible. And I think that is when I started to really come into my own as a person, was playing on that squad. They won a national championship a couple years after I left, and one of my buddies, the guy who started ahead of me, in my position, he plays professional rugby now in Major League Rugby here in the US.
Wow, that is awesome. Now, the thing is though, is that I think too, the other thing is that you went into a situation there with rugby that you were allowed to flourish and grow and do things on your terms. So I think that's probably why it worked out so well for you. I mean, because let's face it, when every time you went into a situation in hockey, if you think about it at the junior level, it wasn't, with the exception of the first year when you were with Toledo, with Varga, that was where the first time where you went in there on your own terms. But then there was the little U-turn when Dunk came in, and then the U-turn the next season, and you like okay, you try to catch on with the team out in Montana. Okay, that's not going there on your own terms of, hey, I tried out, I was recruited by this coach, I was recruited this, that, and the other thing, and it didn't go that route. And so you do that, and then the same thing happens with Motor City. So I mean, when you're going from this to that to this to that to this, and the one team in between folds. Yeah, that's going to be a real confidence booster. Hello. And so when you go to, so you go to Bowling Green and you decide to really make a U-turn, but you made it. You made that decision. It wasn't somebody making the decision for you. You got to put on your big boy pants and make a decision that was going to be best for you. And you succeeded and you flourished. And that allowed you to taste success, and not only taste success, but do it on your terms. And that's what made Alex Wall feel good about himself. And as well you should. You should be proud of that. Now, I mean, what got you to where you're now coaching? I mean, where did you develop that love of the game again?
So I did play one season of club hockey for BG. It was my senior year. I was 25. I was by far the oldest guy on the
They're calling
squad.
you Pops.
And I just could not hang with those guys. They were all like 20, 21, 22. Loved to party, and I was at that point I was like, dude, I just want to be married and having a real job. Not actually, but I just was
Taking a
like, let me
different
get on with my
route,
life. But I wanted to play one more season of competitive hockey, and so I joined in the second semester at BG, and I had fun. I didn't I was old and out of shape, and I was not effective out there. I don't think I even got a point, maybe got one assist in like 10 games. But I wore old 26 for old time's sake, as a throwback to the Cherokee days. And Jed Ortmeyer from University of Michigan, favorite player back in the day. But yeah, I don't know. That kind of got me back into hockey. I also played a lot of like pickup and adult league hockey at BG at the rink there. I worked at the rink for 4 years. And so just being around the game, being around the varsity team as an employee, all that stuff really got me excited about the game again. And when you're so close to the game, but maybe not right in it, it makes it, I think, easier to love. So I had this bird's eye view of this great D1 program. I was also working for the Walleye for a while. I worked for the Toledo Walleye and the Mud Hens for a couple seasons while I was in school, in the control room doing TV and scoreboard stuff. And so just all these experiences helped me fall in love with the game again. And so when I moved to New York City, I started playing in a league here, made a ton of really close friends through that, and eventually I found this organization called Ice Hockey in Harlem. And Ice Hockey in Harlem's whole mission is to get kids on the ice who might not normally have exposure or accessibility otherwise. So, we're getting all kinds of kids from Harlem who all different races and backgrounds and socioeconomic statuses. And it's such an incredible program because it has all these kids falling in love with hockey that otherwise would never see it or never touch ice. And so hockey, even though it has probably shortened my life by 10 or 20 years in a lot of ways, has also given me so much, and I really wanted to give back. So that's why I joined this organization, and I coached 2 seasons now. I coached Mini Mites, and then this past season I coached some Squirt Kids.
Are you looking to maybe eventually move up the chain and try to coach older guys?
Yeah, in New York City it's a little tough. There's only really one rink that's close to me, and I don't really want to be a part of it here, but my goal is to, I think my fiance and I are going to move out of the city at some point in the near future. And there are a lot of great hockey programs in upstate New York and in New Jersey, just over the river. So I really want to get involved with the local program once we move out of the city. And hopefully skill development isn't really my forte, but I think knowing the game and coaching kids and building their confidence, 10 to 14-year-old kids, I think I'll really, that's my wheelhouse for sure.
Wow, and see, the cool part is that you can go to that third and fourth liner and say, I was where you were at, and you can give them that confidence, that boost, give them a speech to let them know that, hey, I've been there, and I can, if I can, I survived. And you can at least give him, say, hey, I know what you need to do so that you can get beyond this and to move up. You can tell them what it is, what it was like, and let them know that, hey, you can finish. It ain't how you start, it's how you finish. So, it's like that's what's most important. And, get and build these kids up, You can coach them up, but sometimes you gotta just love them up and build them up,
Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't know that I ever really had that. I've had some amazing coaches who have done amazing things in their playing career and coaching career, but I don't think I ever really had any single person really pull me aside and say, "Hey, I see you're working your bag off, but this is what I'm seeing, and this is what you need to be doing." And you're so close. Like, I don't know. Maybe I wasn't close though. Maybe I was a bad player. It doesn't matter now, but
Well,
at the time, I think I needed that. I needed love.
sure. And some different players need different things. So, it isn't all just X's and O's. For some kids, it's you need that what's in your, you need to get in their head a little bit and tweak what's in there and maybe get the vacuum cleaner and kind of get some of the crap that's in there out of there and let them just and let and allow them to flourish. And that's why, honestly, I think some of your most successful coaches aren't necessarily guys who were all-star studs in the NHL or played in different, they were in this league and that league and played whatever. It's like a lot of these guys are guys who weren't the top line guy. They weren't the all-star.
Yeah.
They were just guys who they got a good view from the bench or in the stands. And they got to see things. So now that now that they coach, they remember that stuff and they know what it's like. So that's what I'm saying. This is, I guess, the best way you can, I wouldn't say revenge, but you know, like I said, you have that experience to help these kids, these borderline kids that aren't necessarily going to light it up in the NHL, but they still, it doesn't mean that they're not going to contribute. And you've got a chance to impact those kids to be able to go move on to where they can contribute, whether it's at a higher level of hockey or at a higher level of life. And that's to me, that's your role. You know, that's something that you can have a direct impact on. And that is something that you will be able to, I think, impact a lot of kids for years to come if you want to.
I think that's a beautiful way to approach hockey and life, and I definitely want to try to implement that in my techniques of coaching going forward. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, before we wind her up, I want to ask you a couple of things here. I usually finish up with this stuff here with these questions, and that is, I mean, we talked earlier about who is big impact and role models and stuff for you on the or you know growing with hockey, but how about away from the game? Who are some of the people that really impacted you and really meant a lot to you in the course of your life?
Oh, wow. I think this is probably cliche, but it has to be said. My entire family, my both of my parents, blue collar people, didn't have a lot of money, and hockey is just a prohibitively expensive sport. So they sacrificed everything to get me to the rink, to pay the ice bills. Kind of childhood their friends did, because my parents were focused on my sports. And so I just all of them, they gave so much to me and were so influential on and off the ice. And I know you're talking about away from the game, but I just really
Hey, however you
would
want to phrase it,
be
you go.
remiss. And then otherwise, I don't know, they're just, in terms of people in my life, in my circle, I had a lot of great teachers, I had a lot of great professors. My rugby community at BG, Roger Mazzarella, he is the Mr. Maz, as a lot of people call him. He was a high school or middle school teacher in Bowling Green for a long time, and he ran the program from when it started until currently. He's such a unique guy, but he sees the best in everybody, and he's somebody who saw me as like a locker room or a character type player, and leveraged that and helped get the most out of me by focusing on what I was good at, which was like just being a good supporting cast member instead of trying to be the Wayne Gretzky of the rugby club. And I think once I found my niche as like the locker room guy, I really think I thrived. And I think that's helped me in my life outside of sports as well.
Looking at you, I'd say 100% definitely, because you have, and you have, Wooly. I remember when you were a kid. You know, I mean, I can just see the growth in you, and yeah, maybe you know, some people they get motivated by, you know, I was this, I was that, I was so great. Other guys they get motivated by disappointment, when they've had the things didn't always go their way. They use that as motivation to better themselves and then to better the people around them. And I'll take those guys 10 times a day, you know, those guys that understand what real life is and then use it instead of sitting there saying, well, poor me, poor me, poor me. They instead you turn around and use it to motivate themselves to do better so that they don't, you know, it, so that they don't have to have people, you know, around them feel that way, that they can help build them up and stuff. And your upside is so big, so you know, I just think that you know you're doing a great job now, and you know, congratulations on the soon to be marriage. The only question I have is, do you know this yet? No, I'm kidding.
Now, yeah, we haven't moved in together, and I haven't gotten her ring or met her yet, but
Okay.
she'll find out
Well, when she
eventually.
comes, when she shows up at your door in the mail. Okay, I get it. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
My name is Svetlana, yes. Anyway. Goof. Anyway, now last two questions I have. And they're kind of tied together. They're kind of the same thing, but slightly different. And the first one is, what would the Alex Wall of today say to that 16 and 17-year-old Alex Wall? What advice would you give him?
Well, lift weights. I was lazy in the gym. I think that was another part of what kind of derailed my hockey career. So, try to outwork your teammates in the gym, and it'll help you off the ice or on the ice. But ultimately, play hockey because because it's fun. Don't play it because you think it'll make your parents happy. Excuse me, or because you think you're going to go to the NHL. Or whatever. Do what you love, and everything else is going to work out. And I wish that, excuse me, I wish that I would have focused more on what made me happy about hockey than what I thought hockey could do for me later on. And if I would have done that, I think hockey would have been a lot more fun. And I might have gone further in the sport if I focused on having fun. But ultimately, I have no regrets about the way things turned out, and I'm really happy with where I'm at in my life. And hockey is fun again. It just took a while to get back to that place.
Hey, as long as you got there, that's all that counts. You got there. And they don't ask, as far as how long did it take you? No, it's are you there? Okay, good. That's the key. Now, the last thing I always end this with is, what would you like to say to Cherokee Nation? Because alumni listen, alumni coaches, fans are really big. Kids, the current members of the team. They all listen to this stuff. Why, I don't know, but it ain't me. It's obviously the guys that they want to hear from that went through this. I just wanted to give you the opportunity, like I do everyone else, to be able to address Cherokee Nation, if anything you got to say.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I think what I loved about the club was that it was like the fabric of the team was made up by incredible people. All my teammates were great. The coaches were great. Maybe I didn't fit in with the group as much as some of the other guys did, but it was still a great group of people. And I think representing a city like Toledo is so meaningful because it's just such a hardworking, blue collar city that I was so proud to put on that Toledo jersey every weekend. And I hope that the guys that play for the club now know that they are a part of a huge hockey lineage in a crazy hockey city. I mean, it's crazy to think about how far back Toledo hockey goes in whatever iteration you think of, from the Gold Diggers, probably even before that,
Oh yeah,
the Storm, Walleye. Yeah.
Hornets, the
So
Blades, yeah, Mercuries.
Much hockey history, and just to be a part of that is really special. And I'm sure that's not lost on the current group of players, but I hope they know how lucky they are to represent that club and that city every day.
Well, you know what? I'm sure. I hope they are too. But it's always good to know that there's alumni out there that are good people too. And I'm talking to one right now. So, Alex, I can't thank you enough for doing this, man. This has been fun. I've really enjoyed this a lot. And like I said, the best of luck with all the future endeavors and stuff. And don't be a stranger, man. Toledo can always use a good visitor to come and hang out over here. Now I know you're over there in the Big Apple, but when and especially when we have the reunion, that's the thing. We're gonna have a reunion, and yeah, there'll probably be an alumni game or something, but the big thing for me is I want us to get a bunch of us from different eras, doesn't matter, just to all get together and go watch a Cherokee game and sit there, have a couple of Diet Dr. Peppers, and just laugh ourselves silly. talking about the old
Oh
days.
man. That's I would love to be a part of that. And if that needs some if you need some help with that, you know where to find me, and we can talk offline about that, but I would love to be a part of
Well, you're in. Don't worry, you're in, buddy. So
that.
you don't have to think twice about that one. But Alex, I thank you so much for this, and again, we'll keep in touch. So thanks, bud, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, Mick. It's great chatting with you, and I hope we can do something like this again soon. Thanks so much for having me
Yep,
on.
you bet. That's episode 92 of the Cherokee Rewind. Don't forget, just subscribe at whatever platform you use, whether it's iHeart, Spotify, Google, Amazon, whatever podcasts that you consume you're listening to. You just put in Cherokee Rewind, hit the subscribe button, and every time a new episode drops, it'll notify you. So for Alex Wool, I am Mick saying thanks a lot, and we'll catch you next time right here on the Cherokee Rewind.